You'll be asleep within 30 minutes. Which will be great because we'll start to talk about you. I'm grateful for the opportunity to be here. In gatherings like this, I just want to acknowledge that following Jesus is hard to do. Amen?
Amen.
And it's not hard because we're stupid or because we're not working hard enough or because we don't care. It's hard because it's just hard to do. Like, you know, he used metaphors like cross and not Tesla. There's a difference between those two. And he said things like, the gates and the road are narrow. And you know, in our moment, in our world, we would like to think that the gate would be as broad as possible. But the reality is that I remember listening to Dallas Willard give a lecture once, and his kind of Missouri drawl, him say, God will let anyone into his heaven who can take it. And there is a certain sense in which, you know, Willard was not talking about people who have worked enough to prove that they deserve to enter. It's more a matter, are you willing to allow yourself to be loved this deeply? Are you willing to allow yourself to do the work of becoming vulnerable? All those things that we've been talking about already this morning. Are you willing to allow, the woman who had the bleeding dysphagia, she didn't have to present herself. She could have just slunk back into the crowd from whence she came and left with her bleeding stopped, but so much of her life left yet needing to be healed. And so it takes great courage, and it takes a lot of work. And it takes the kind of work we would say it's the most beautiful work we'll ever do, and it's also the hardest work we'll ever do. And some of that includes our topic that we're going to talk about this afternoon, this notion of suffering. And we want to say that the Christian story is the one story that honors suffering. It does not make it to be more or less than what it is, but it honors its place in the world. And one of the ways for us to talk about what suffering is that suffering is this response, the natural response of the world to the depth of its predicament. Like, it's kind of like if you sprain your ankle, you're going to have an inflammatory response. Because that's the nature of what happens when an ankle is injured. If you break your ankle, you're going to have an inflammatory response and other things that are going to be more difficult, which is the ankle's natural response to the predicament in which it finds itself. In many respects, this is what human suffering is. It is our response. It is the response of the world that is in anguish itself, the creation itself, that groans waiting for the revelation of the sons and daughters of God. The creation itself is suffering, waiting, living in the place that its natural consequence because of the life that we've chosen to live here, if that makes sense. And the Christian story does not flinch from this. It does not conduct business as Western metaphysics would, which tend to say suffering is universally bad and we're going to do everything that we can to rid ourselves of it, and any place where it is we must continue to do whatever we can to rid ourselves of it, and even if we can't, then we're just going to say that it's a bad thing. And that's the end of the story as far as Western metaphysics are concerned. We have Eastern metaphysics that tell us a different story. They want us to ultimately live as if suffering doesn't really exist. I'm just going to choose not to pay attention to it. The mechanics of silence, the mechanics of that kind of way of being in the world, are beautiful mechanics, except at some point you have to deal with the reality that some people are suffering and you can't stop it. And so what do we do with that? And we would say the Christian story is the one story that looks at that and says God enters into it. God doesn't just talk about suffering. God enters into suffering with us. It's not a thing that God talks about. It is a thing that God enters into. And in the same way, says, I see where you are, and I'm not just going to leave you there and talk about you and your suffering. I'm going to come be with you in it. And in the very sense of being with us, there's that whole thing again, this haunting word of 2:18 of Genesis. Being with you, we're going to allow your suffering not only to be transformed, but we are going to allow it to transform you. And this is the only story that does this. Let's talk a little bit more about it. As we do, especially for those, I've come today being aware that many of us are in the helping profession of some kind. You're psychotherapists, or pastors, others. And these are phrases that I want us to consider. You know, one of the things that trauma does, trauma, as we like to say, those of us who know about this, when we have experiences that are defined by trauma, one of the things that happens is that our imaginations are shattered. Right? There's nothing that you do that is not preceded by your imagined sense of doing it. Are you with me? Imagination is always preceding things that we do. I'm walking across the stage, and there is a part of my brain that is imagining ahead of time that this is what I'm not just going to do, but I'm able to do this. We're imagining this. Are you with me? You think, like, man, that dude is constantly wondering if he's lost because he keeps asking people if they're with him. Yes, like, nobody's left. Nobody's moved. Yes, we're still here. Thank you very much. That part of me that's still worrying behind Montable. Just wondering if you see, just picture you're not leaving. Are you with me? Okay. Just check it. But then I can't remember what I was saying. You're with me. I'm not with me. What was I saying? Walking across. Right. So you're walking across. And so, but our imaginations are continually being expanded so that our bodies and the rest of us can then catch up to this. I mean, this is what parenting is doing all the time. Are you with me? My wife, who's a child development specialist, likes to say that one of the jobs of the parents is to interpret the world for the child. That's what we do. But we also like to say that every human system, the church, schools, business, the government, football teams, are all modeled after the family. They all are. You can't get away from it. Which means that there's always going to be somebody who's in the role of a parent. Somebody will be. Somebody's going to be in the role of the firstborn child. Somebody's going to be in the role of the lastborn child. You with me? And here's the thing. The parents, when it comes to parenting, part of their role is to interpret the world for the child. And they have to work at imagining things for the child while the child's imagination is trying to catch up. We start to teach our children to say please and thank you at a very early age, long before they have any idea about the notion of gratitude. They don't know what gratitude is. They have no idea. Their little prefrontal cortex can't capture this. Please, thank you. They're just going to be little automatons. We're just training them to do these things. But their imaginations are going to catch up to ours. This is what we're doing all the time. But let's just remember, this is what the entire biblical narrative is about. The entire biblical narrative is God's attempt to imagine things for us while ours is trying to catch up to his. This is what Jesus is doing with parables. He's offering the possibility of imagination being expanded, and ours is trying to catch up. And it's hard for little ones to catch up to their parents' imagination in the same way that it's difficult for us as followers of Jesus to catch up to his imagination for us. It's easy for us to believe that we are problems waiting to be solved. Imagining that we are icons of beauty waiting to emerge is a whole different kettle of fish. But someone has to be in the room who helps us imagine this so that our imaginations can't catch up. This is how the mind works all the time. And so, whenever we are with others, we have to remember that we are border stalkers. My friend Mako Fujimura, the Japanese-American painter, likes to talk about that artists are border stalkers, and I would say that every human being who's a follower of Jesus is a border stalker. What does this mean? You are continually walking the line between the real world that you occupy as a follower of Jesus, right? It's the age to come that is already here, that hasn't come in its fullness yet. Yes? I'm in that realm, but I'm also in another realm. I'm in the realm with my patients, and my patients have a particular way of understanding the world the way that they understand it, and it's a misunderstanding of the world. And I'm stalking the border, which means I'm continually having to pay attention to where I am and where they are, and where I am, where. This is what parenting does. This is what we do with our patients. This is what we do for the CEO of a company. This is what we do for the pastor of the church. This is what we do in many, many different realms. We are stalking the border between our story and yours. If I'm in the checkout line at Safeway, I'm a border stalker. Okay? Imagine yourself what will it be like for you to practice. For the next 6 weeks, every day before you leave your house, make it a practice, make it a purpose to say, I'm stalking borders today. I'm not kidding. Right? This is what I'm doing. I'm stalking borders. This is what Jesus is doing when he leaves heaven. When he comes to earth and he's stalking the border. What was Eden? Eden is nothing more than the borders coming together. Right? It's heaven on earth. And what are we doing? We are outposts of Eden. He said, we're expanding the border into another border. Okay? We're border stalkers. But as we stalk the border, we are observers. We're not critics. We're observers. We are primarily observers. I'm making observation. One of the most important things that we do as therapists, as we are talking with our patients, is say the sentence, I'm observing that. Fill in the blank. I'm observing myself respond to your response. And I'm observing that I think I want to yell at your mother. Or I think I want to yell at you. That's a little more risky to say, but you know what I mean. Right? I'm observing something. I'm not here to tell you what is true or what is not true about everything. I'm making an observation. Because when I make an observation, then I interpret things. This is what parents do with children. We are interpreting the world for them. And interpretation is the telling of a story, right? When you talk about the translation of Scripture, the translation of a Scripture is the interpretation of Scripture, because at some point, if I'm looking at the Greek and I have to decide what does the Greek mean in English, I have to interpret it. I'm not just changing words, because sometimes we don't have words for what they have. I'm having to make an interpretation. We are doing this all the time. I'm walking across the stage and I'm interpreting that the stage is going to hold. Now, I don't spend a lot of time, you know, letting people know that, by the way, I'm just letting you know that I'm thinking that the stage is going to hold. Literally, most of the life of the world that we are interpreting, we're not talking about. Most of what we encounter in the world is encountering the parts of our brain that doesn't have to do explicit real-time interpretation. It's become automatically subsumed into that part of our mind that's acting. I'm driving down the highway, but I'm thinking about something else, but I'm able to drive while I'm having a conversation with my friend who's in the car with me. There are other parts of my brain that are interpreting the signals and the speed and everything else about my car while I'm interpreting the conversation that we're having here. So we can do this in multiple different dimensions. You're thinking, what's this got to do with suffering? It has everything to do with it, because as we're soon going to see, suffering has a lot to do with how we interpret the world. It's not just a thing that happens to happen to us. It's a thing that we experience and is a description of our response to pain as a function of the world that we're interpreting long before the suffering ever gets here. Does that make sense? So this gets back to what we were saying earlier, like, in what story do we believe that we're living? We talk about these border stalkers' awareness of multiple time, space, dimensions. We don't need to talk a lot about this, so we don't have all day to talk about this. But we'll just say, there's lots of things that you're paying attention to at one time. One of the things that we, in these confessional communities that we run, we talk about how in the confessional community there are three phases at which they emerge. The first phase is this. People come together in a group, 6 to 8 people, and we're going to tell our story. And most people are coming together because they really, I say it's kind of like you have a plumbing problem and you're coming to Home Depot to get to the plumbing section. Right? I have a plumbing problem. So I come to these groups because I have a problem with my marriage, or I have a thing with my depression, right? Like these things outside the group, right? That are the things that I want to talk about. This is one dimension of my life, and I think that's why I'm coming to the group. But then I come to the group, and I come to the group frequently enough. I come to this community frequently enough. As I'm telling my story, and I'm hearing John and Sarah and Shirley and Bill tell their stories. And as I do, I discover, oh my gosh, every time I come to Home Depot, I see these same people in the plumbing section. And they're here, and oddly enough, they have similar, not exactly the same, but they have similar problems in their house as well, with their plumbing. Like, gosh, there are a lot of houses in Northern Virginia that have plumbing problems. Because we're all here, we're talking about plumbing. And now I feel better, because there are other people who have plumbing problems. I don't feel so alone with my plumbing problem. But the problem is still in my house, it's not here in the group. Are you with me? So now we have two dimensions. We have this domain of like what's happening out there in my house. But now it's like, oh my gosh, there's a domain in here. Like, I feel like I've got some people with, like, I'm doing this together. And then one day you come and you discover, oh my goodness, Home Depot has plumbing problems. Because what you've come to discover is that we've been here long enough that I am no longer having to work to make sure that I'm not pissing people off, and so I do. Because at some point, you're going to become comfortable enough in this community to say something, and it's going to make, John's not going to be happy with that. Or Karen's not going to be happy with that. Because there's more and more of your real self that starts to show up in the room. And we discover, oh my goodness, there's yet another domain of things that are happening. And it's not just what's happening out there, it's what's happening in the room right now. Are you with me? And here's what's important about this. I can talk forever in a day in this group about what's happening at home, and there's not much they're going to be able to do about what's happening at home. But as soon as the problem shows up in the room, now we can do something. And not only that, I can guarantee you the problem that's happening in the room is the same one that's happening at home. Only when it's in the room, now I can take action with the other people in the room with whom I'm having the same problem that I'm having with my wife, with my husband, with whosoever. And now I can become changed here in the room because I recognize that I am where the problem is. So you see, we're having to pay attention to lots of different dimensions of all the things that are taking place. And we could go on and on and on about all the different ways in which these things happen in a confessional community, not just in terms of the things we're talking about, but all of the dynamics that are happening, the emotions in the room, the things that people feel and say and do, and all the things. But it's just a highlight that when we're stopping the border, we're paying attention to lots of different stuff. And it takes practice and it takes work, just like you're doing when you're parenting a kid. So you have lots of these time-space dimensions, these multiple domains of integration. Right? We talked about those 9 domains. We're going to be curious about all that. This is a lot of work to do. This is the work you're doing as a therapist. You're paying attention to all 9 domains, back and forth and back and forth. It's a lot of work. Right? You say, like, look, it's a lot of work to be a parent, amen? And the only way you don't screw up your kid is don't happen. It's the only way you don't. Right? Because kids don't need parents who are perfect. Thanks be to God, because we're not. Kids need parents who are attuned and who are able to repair ruptures while we are helping their imaginations move in the direction of the kingdom of God. This is what kids need. So we can own our mistakes, and we can say, the problem is, like, here is where this is the space where we are creating beauty and goodness. In this space. And this is why, again, we say that, like, when it comes to taking care of patients, and we think that they're coming for the EMDR that will help them at home, or the IFS that will help them at home, all those things are true, but the most important thing that's happening is what's happening in the room between you and them. And the last thing we'll say, working within the guidance of the tripod of awareness. Now, this, I'll just say this real quick. But some of you are familiar with this. Is this right? Yeah, no, it's not right. There we go. 3 things. Here's a question for us as therapists. Here's a question we can ask our patients. It's a simple thing that they can begin to practice and train their minds. Are you open? Are you observant? And are you objective? To be open means Am I able to tolerate the entire range of emotional states that I'm going to encounter between now and the time I go to bed tonight? Am I going to be open to all the things that I sense and image and feel and think? And by open, I don't mean, am I willing to, if I'm open to, does that mean like, oh, I have the impulse to want to look at pornography. Am I open to doing that? No, I'm not talking about being open to looking at pornography. What I'm asking you is, are you open to paying attention to the first impulse that you had that had you wanting to look at pornography? Are you open to being, are you open to what is going on with me long before I look at pornography, or what is going on with me that I'm sensing, that I'm in, that I, that this impulse that I have? For many of us, because we are not willing to even be open to it at all, we bury it and it will come back, and before we know it, we will be looking at pornography as a way to combat that thing that we're trying to bury. Are you with me? So we want to be open, but we also then want to be observant. And by observant, I mean we are going to be curious about this. We are not going to be people of condemnation. There are lots of things that people will say, like, well, no, I had that sense of wanting to look at porn, or I had that sense of wanting to take the extra drink, or I wanted to yell at whoever or whatever, and so I know that I shouldn't do that, so I just turned that off. Well, there's no question that when given the option of yelling at my child or not yelling at my child, it's a better idea to not yell at my child. But it would be a mistake for me to somehow pretend that I don't or shouldn't want to yell at my child and then do nothing about it. Because when I bury that, if I'm not open enough and then observe it enough, I would be yelling at my child. Guaranteed. And so I want to be observant without condemnation. I want to be curious, not condemning, so that I can get to the point of being objective. By objective, I don't mean as opposed to subjective. I mean objective, meaning that if I'm able to be open and able to be observant enough of all the different dimensions and domains of what's happening in the room, then I get to see the entire object of what's happening in the room. I get to hear more about my story. I get to hear more about the story of my child that just come home from third grade with something that I already know about because the teacher's called me. Am I able to be completely objective to see the entirety of the story that belongs to me and to the other? When we leave the tripod of awareness, we can then find that our interpretive mechanism moves from being curious and being collaborative. I want to do this with the other. I'm not just going to foist my idea on somebody else. I want to, as often as I can, be curious. Tell me what you think that's about. What's your imagination telling you? What's the story that you're telling yourself? What's the word? And, you know, people are telling, we said earlier, like, we're storytellers, and people don't know that they're doing this until someone else invites them to say, tell me, what's the story that you're telling? They're like, what do you mean? What story am I telling? Right. The story that you're, they don't know this. Because no one has ever been curious enough with them to let them in on the fact that they're telling stories about things. And so we are going to collaborate with them in helping them tell their story and then bring it to a place of crystallization. By crystallization, I mean things crystallize for people. People come to places of discovery. People come to places of revelation because we have been collaboratively, curiously stalking the border. Okay. What does it mean to be human? Definition of anthropology. We're saying this. This is important because I tell clinicians this. I'll just say this briefly. Of course, we want you to know your psychology. We want you to know your neuroscience. And for you prescribers, we want you to know your drug interactions. And we want you to know your, we want you to know the neurophysiology. And we want you to know all of your psychotherapy intervention tactics. But even more so, you need to be rigorous about your anthropology. You need to be, you don't need to be perfect at it, you need to be rigorous. You have to be able to answer the question, what does it mean to be human? Because here's what I'm going to tell you what most of us think it means to be human. Most of us, how many, are you familiar with the thing called the DSM? Yeah. How many of you, like, really, really, really like the DSM? All right, the laughter tells us something already. Right, we know that the DSM, you know, no one, if I were asked the question, how many of you really like Beethoven's Ninth Symphony? There's not going to be the same kind of laughter, because if you've heard it, you're overwhelmed by it. If you've been to the Grand Canyon, you're overwhelmed by it. If you've seen Van Gogh up close from 2 feet away, you're overwhelmed by it. Well, when we ask, you think of the DSM, and we have the kind of laughter that we have, it tells us something's up with this. Are you with me? And we're not to say that it's bad, but what I'm saying is it is a representation that we humans have become categorized and siloed as diagnostic categories. And so when someone walks into our office, we're already thinking about how we're going to check the boxes so that we can make the diagnosis, so that we can implement the proper treatment modalities. This is not a bad thing. It's just that this is what we are limited to thinking in terms of what this person actually is. We're not imagining them to be an icon of beauty that is waiting to be revealed. They think, oh, come on, girl, that's fine, that's good. But like, what practical value does that have? Exactly. The fact that we only think in terms of people being objects of practical value is problematic and it's not biblical. And so until we are paying attention to what it means for us to be human, it will be difficult for us to do our job. Now, this we could spend 2 days on. It's all about the question of how do we, as people who are Jesus followers, become multilinguistic interpreters. Some of you might be familiar with a gentleman by the name of Tom Wright, N.T. Wright. He's a British theologian, New Testament scholar. And I was at a conference once where he was speaking, and he's in the middle of talking about something about Galatians, and he's saying, you know, in his British accent, he's saying, and you know, Paul was, and then he just drops in Galatians, and he just drops into Greek. I didn't even know that they spoke ancient Greek, but he starts to speak Greek, and you're like, hello. And he's not, of course, because he's saying it as if he thinks that we all know, like, understand exactly what he's saying. But you see what I mean? He's speaking seamlessly. I would love for the clinicians in this audience to get to a point where it is seamless for you to be talking in one moment about implicit memory, and in the next moment, describe how it is that shows up in the 8th chapter of Deuteronomy. I would like for you to be talking about what it means for you to pay attention to epigenetics and long-term memory and the way that we narrate through attachment, and then immediately share how that's reflected in the 16th verse of the 6th chapter of Jeremiah. You can do this. What does it have to do? What does Mark chapter 5 verses 1 through 5 and 1 through 26 in the story of the woman have to do with what it means for us to pay attention to trauma? You follow? This takes the kind of hard work that makes it's a very different thing than somehow thinking that to be a Christian and to be a therapist means that we can do all the therapy stuff, and then we can somehow, like, we'll just layer a Bible verse on top of this, and somehow magically it all becomes the same thing. That's easy to do and not very helpful. Are you with me? So when we talk about becoming all these things you're talking about, we're doing all this because we're entering into people's suffering. And the way that we enter into it most effectively is if we are able to understand its multiple different dimensions when it shows up. Okay, here's how we're going to do this. We're going to walk through the first 5 verses of Romans chapter 5. We're going to go pretty quickly because we don't have that much time. All right, you ready? You can read this. You can read it on your phones or whatever, so I'm going to go to the next slide because you know that, okay? Therefore, since you've been justified by faith, and what is faith? I want to invite you to consider, first of all, that when it comes to suffering, if you were to just ask someone, do you suffer? Everyone would be able to say yes, and they should be able to point to some place in their life where that's true. If they can't, it may be true that they're not suffering currently. It's just a matter of time. We know this. But it's important to know that as Jesus followers, we do not simply enter into the topic of suffering without first making sure that we have a proper understanding of the on-ramp that we take to get there. This is crucially important. That by the time Paul gets to suffering in the 3rd verse of this section of his letter to the church of Rome, by the time he gets there, there's a lot of other ground that he has covered that is preparing us to comprehend and to enter into, even in our neurophysiology, with the suffering that we carry. Therefore, since we've been justified by faith. And what is faith? Faith is primarily an act of trust. And trust is primarily an act of attachment. Even without being a neuroscientist, even without being an attachment specialist, what Paul is talking about when he talks about faith, justification by faith, he's really talking about, from an embodied standpoint, he's talking about the evolution of attachment. He's talking about the development of attachment that we have, in this case, with Jesus. But the notion of being attached to Jesus is always going to be done, it's always going to be mediated by my attachment to his body. You get that right? We are the gospel. If we were to disappear from the earth, God wouldn't disappear, but the notion of the gospel and his proclamation would be tough to come by because, like, somehow, God has decided that we're going to be his collaborators. Like, he's really, it's a risk. And it is one that he was willing to take by making us in the first place. Are you with me? And so this notion of when people think about trusting in God, the question is always, what is your attachment pattern like? Now, many of us in this room, therapists, like, you are deeply familiar with attachment. You do attachment work. That's not new information to us. But again, the real question for us is, in what way are our own attachment patterns as therapists being regularly revisited? Because before we can talk with patients about their suffering, we first have to recognize that their attachment patterns are going to be the foundational thing that set them up to interpret and to understand and comprehend and do what they're going to do with their suffering. So that's the first question. Therefore, since we've been justified by faith, we have peace with God. We have peace with God. Through our Lord Jesus Christ, we have peace with God. Let me all just say, I said that when it comes to hope, by the way, nobody in this room can live without hope. Sometimes we talk about hope as a thing, we only begin to talk about it when we are worried that we won't have it. Okay? Like, if I'm going to go to the baseball game, I hope it doesn't rain. I'm only really thinking that much about rain if it's going to interfere with my life. Otherwise, I'm not thinking that much about rain. Are you with me? But the reality is that I'm hoping, once again, not to overuse this metaphor, but I'm hoping that the stage holds with every step that I take. I'm hoping that it will. I live as if I hope that it will, even though I'm not thinking about this consciously. But there's not a thing that we do that is not a hopeful anticipation of the next moment. What stands out is that we begin to pay attention to and talk about hope the moment we think it's not going to be there. And so attachment is the early construction of hope. Hope is not separate from attachment. When I'm developing attachment, you are training my brain to believe that when I cry, you will come. Hope is that which is being constructed early on in the neural networks of the newborn and the infant and the toddler. And that attachment construction project is going to be groundwork for the degree to which I'm able to hope about a lot of things in the rest of my life when it will feel like hope is out of reach. And so when we say, you know, you're talking to somebody, you're doing a suicide prevention check, and a person says, no, I don't feel very hopeful, and we say, we talk about that, you know, and that's a big box that we're going to check and we're going to look at if we're assessing for suicide. But what we know is that we talk about hope as if it's just this standalone thing. I can guarantee you, it's not that. It's all about, first and foremost, what's the attachment process that's happening right here and now. It's crucial that we pay attention to that. So that's the early construction of that. And then this whole notion of we are at war with God. Anybody, we've already agreed that the Chosen is, you know, probably right next to Scripture, right? Anybody here watch that, the Chosen? Yeah. Have you gone to the theaters to see season 4? Some folks have? No. Some have? Yeah, okay. I understand it's pretty good. Yeah. I haven't done that, but I've watched the first 3 seasons 5 times. And you're like, dude. got to get a life, man. Don't you have things to do? But the other pillar of my spiritual formation for the last 3 years is a gang of people in Portland called the Bible Project. Do you know about these folks? Like, these guys are just wicked cool, right? I've had a chance to become friends with them, and they talk this beautiful thing about they talk about the ancient cosmology. They do a whole series on the ancient cosmology, and this notion that if you look at creation narratives of ancient Near Eastern religious cults, so that would be the Egyptians and the Sumerians, the Babylonians, the Assyrians. If you look at their stories, all very much feel familiar to that of the first two chapters of the Bible. They all feel very familiar to that, with one major difference. There are some differences, but here's a major difference. In every single creation narrative of everybody else, the God who eventually creates human beings first must go to war with the world in order to do it. They go to war with another god, they go to war with nature, they go to war, but it is a violent God who makes human beings. What do the Hebrews say? The first line of the Bible is, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. It's like a chapter head. And then the chapter begins. The earth was what? Earth was formless and void, and darkness covered the face of the earth as a wind of the Spirit of God swept over the deep. Swept is one word. Another word is hovered. The God of the Bible is a God who comes to chaos and hovers. He does not come and commit acts of violence. He comes and hovers. Our role as psychotherapists is to come and hover. And then what does God do? He speaks, let there be light. And then he speaks again, and then he says, let the water above be separate from the water below, and then let the land separate from the water, and then let the land bring forth vegetation. Let there be, and it was. He speaks, and he brings order and purpose, but there is no violence. Now here's the thing. When Paul would say this to his people, to the church at Rome, it would be important to know this was a cataclysmic deal. There would be no other way of thinking. We think it's like, okay, like, why are we, of course we know we have peace with God, because it's 2,000 years after Jesus was here, we kind of all, and frankly, most of us probably, have not been in active combat in this room. I would guess that. Most of us haven't been. It's no fun. There's nothing sexy about it. It's awful. And Paul is saying, that's not the life that we have with this God. Everybody in the near Middle Eastern time in the ancient world would have believed that the gods were at war with them. It was a real thing. Your crops depended upon it. Whether or not your family could have kids depended upon it. Whether or not the next legion walked into your neighborhood and ran everything over it depended. I have to make sure that I'm not at war with God. It's just assumed that God is at war with us. What can I do to make sure this doesn't happen? Here's the thing. Everybody in this room, we have parts of us that believe that we are at war with God, even though we would claim that that's not the case. This is where internal family systems can be really, really helpful. Because I know that the part of me, this is true for me, the part of me that has for many years believed that God is a tyrant, believes that he's at war with me, even if I think that I'm not at war with him. Adam, in Genesis 3, when he hears God walking in the cool of the afternoon, he thinks he's coming to kill him. I mean, this is the word, right? On the day that you eat of the fruit, you're going to die. Adam's interpretation, God's coming to kill me. Most of us in this room have parts of us that believe the same thing. It's just that I'm so unaware of them that I don't even know that I'm still at war with God. What Paul is saying is that before we get to talking about suffering, we have to talk about the parts of us that still believe that we are at war with God. And this gets back to the question of who is my great cloud of witnesses? By whom might it be asked the question, what parts of you, Kurt, believes that you and God are still at war? And these are questions that are, this is not just a question that we ask once a year. This is a question that we ask every day. Evil will not want us to ask this question, let alone answer it. What parts of us are still at war with God? And we stand in grace, because we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we have obtained access to this grace in which we now stand. Notice, Paul doesn't say the grace that we have, we stand in it. It is a testimony to the fact that our physicality, we've said earlier, grace is not a thing that I can make any sense of if it is merely a theological concept. Grace is what happens in a confessional community in which someone who's figured out that we have plumbing problems at Home Depot. It's what happens when someone looks across the room after having just said to them, I think I'm really mad at you. I'm really angry with you for what you just said. And the response is not one in which they get up and leave the room. I said to you earlier, I grew up in a house where I practiced learning to be afraid of anger. And then I got married. I think I said that, right?
Yes.
And now I'm not just like aware that I'm angry, now I'm anxious. Now I'm worried in addition. And here's the thing. Until and or unless I'm actually able to have experiences in which I become comfortable with the widest range of emotional states that exist, I'm not going to be able to be loving. Because those parts of me that feel all these things that are related to the parts of me that have been wounded, that have not been named, are the parts that will then quickly be put away. And these will be parts that I won't want you to touch, I won't want you to come, I won't want you to ask me any questions about. But they will also be parts that I'm going to have a hard time regulating when that emotion shows up in the room in somebody else. My colleague Courtney Morrison, she likes to talk about emotion being contagious. I love this when she talks about this. It's contagious. And here's how it will show up in one of these confessional communities. You've got 8 or 9 people in this room, and you have one person, somebody starts to tell their story, and another person in the room starts to become really agitated about this. There's only one person who's getting, have you ever been in a place where like you're with one, you're like in an elder board meeting. Anybody ever been in an elder board meeting? Yeah, okay. You're in an elder board meeting, and you're trying, and a particular subject is introduced to the topic. And one person starts to get irritated. Has that ever happened? Well, your elders are perfect. Does that ever happen? Like something like what? Have you ever been sitting at your kitchen table and one person becomes really angry about something? And everybody else at the table seems not to be nearly as angry as that person. Are you with me so far? Right? And it's easy for us all to like look at each other and then look at the person, and we would say, let's say the person's name is Charlie. Anybody here named Charlie? Okay, lucky for me. All right, the person's name is Charlie. And we're like, Charlie, like, what's your problem? When what's really happening is that Charlie has become the flashpoint for everybody's anger in the room. It's not just Charlie who's mad. Charlie's anger is showing up on behalf of everybody who won't say that they are. Are you with me? This is not what happens all the time. Sometimes Charlie's just pissed off. But it is not uncommon for these kinds of things to happen. And the reason that it is important for us to be aware of this is that we start to notice this in our very physicality. And so grace is not just something that I'm going to like, well, you need to give Charlie grace. No, I need to give Charlie like something else. I need to ask Charlie a question. I actually need to give Charlie myself and say, as it turns out, Charlie, I think I'm pretty angry too. Only I've been too afraid to say it and you weren't. Are you with me? This is happening everywhere we go. This is not just happening in psychotherapeutic confessional community circles. This is happening in your kitchen. This is happening in the elder community. This is happening in classrooms. This is happening in youth groups. This is happening between people, like, without words, this is happening between people on I-95. All right? Do you think quantum mechanics doesn't work? You have one, you've seen that one driver, right? The one driver that you're all in agreement, even though you're not saying, like, that's the driver that should not have their license, right? But the one driver is expressing what we're all feeling. We're all fed up with what's happening on I-95. We have just one person who's willing to say it with their car. Yeah. And so this whole notion of paying attention to what's happening, remember, we're getting stuff there. But this is the on-ramp to this, the things that we're paying attention to. What is happening in my body? The brain operates bottom to top and right to left. And if we are not paying attention to the way it operates, we will often miss what it is trying to tell us. And then Paul makes this term where he talks about, this notion of this grace in which we now stand. And we boast in the anticipation of the glory of God. Now, what do we mean by glory here? This is important, because this is going to send us then right into the whole question about suffering. Glory means lots of different things in the texts of Scripture. Glory can mean God's grandeur, God's very presence, His beauty, His awesomeness, His power. All the things about God that are glorified. All these things are true. What I'm paying attention to here, and what I'm inviting us to pay attention to, with what Paul's paying attention to, is what Leslie Newbegin draws our attention to in John's Gospel. Because like no other text in the Scripture, John's Gospel talks about the glory of God like no other text does. We get it in the very first column of the text. For the Word dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory, the glory as of the only Son of the Father. And what Newbegin rightly points out is that when John talks about glory, he's talking about the glory of what's happening between two people. The glory of what's happening between a father and his boy. The glory of what's happening between the father who said, You are my son whom I love, and I am pleased with you. This sense that every single one of us is experiencing, whether we know it or not, the utter and infinite delight of God the Father. That we are His glory. Now's when we start to get nervous. The Calvinists in the room start to turn their toes under their shoes. Right? Right? This sense of what it means for us to consider what Paul's writing about in 2 Corinthians chapter 4 when he talks about this weight of glory that we are going to have to be able to stand up under when heaven gets here. And C.S. Lewis, in his sermon by the same title, The Weight of Glory, has this beautiful little story that he tells. And does anybody here own a dog? All right. I see you own dogs. And do you like your dog? Sometimes. Maybe your dog wants to live someplace else. Okay, sorry, that was not fair. It may be true, but it wasn't fair. Okay, all right. So when you come home, if your dog is healthy, when you come home, does your dog? If your dog is like 15 years old. I mean, if your dog is like young, and you come in the house, what does your dog tend to do? Let your dog come to you. Does your dog like seeing you? Yes. And does your dog like you seeing your dog? And your dog loses its mind because it is so excited not just to see you. I can assure you, it's not that excited to see you. Okay, that was a little funny. Come on. All right. It's more excited to be seen by you. That's why your dog is so excited. Now, yes, it's excited to see you, but it's excited to see you because it knows that you are going to lose your mind when you see the dog. And Lewis says this: there is no greater joy or purpose for a dog than to know that that dog has acquired the joy of its master. When that dog sees and experiences the joy of its master wanting to be with the dog, that's what the dog knows. It's doing what it was made to do. evil does not want us to know that the heaven that is coming is like our dad getting home from work. And we are the animal that sees our owner see us, and we see him lose his mind with delight that we get to be his. This is the glory that Paul is talking about. We boast. It's like if dolls could talk, right? If they really were, right, in a Far Side comic strip, if they really were, or if they're in some kind of C.S. Lewis, like, fiction novel, right? Dogs would talk about the pleasure that they have when their owners come home. And this is the pleasure that was like when the king comes. The joy that we have is in knowing that the king is coming for us. And this is what Paul wants us to pay attention to as he takes us into this next step. This glory of the only Son of the Father is what he says we're going to boast in. Like, this is what we're going to have. This is what it's going to be like for us. And with that in mind, we then start to talk about suffering. This notion of suffering takes into consideration this joy that we have. This notion that we talk in other places, and Siegel talks about this, we could talk a lot about this, this notion that we have a relationship in which we are seen, soothed, safe, secure. That we have a relationship in which ruptures are being repaired. Right? All of this constitutes this glory that is preparing us for this suffering that we'll experience. This notion, many of you have, like you've talked about, you've explored, or you've studied Stephen Porges' work on the polyvagal theory, this notion of the window of tolerance, how we are increasingly, and this is what parenting is about, we are expanding a child's capacity to tolerate an entire panoply of emotional states, right? So that we can, no matter what the emotional state is, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, that we get to a point where we know that we can be okay with not being okay, because we are not left alone in the room with it. Because at the end of the day, our master's coming home. Are you with me? So, there's a, I think there's a book for sale here, one called, what's it called? The Soul of Desire, thank you. Memory, okay. And in this book, we talk about this notion that we are a people of great desire. We've said this already here before. We're people of great longing. We come out of the world, out of the universe, into the world, longing for things. We're longing for breath. We're longing for food. We're longing for nourishment. We're longing for all kinds of things physically. But then we get to this place where we long to be seen, soothed, safe, secure, in order for us to then have this desire going on to create things, right? Because when children are nurtured well, they find that their creative juices are just flying off their fingertips. You don't have to teach them to want to make stuff. They bring things to you, right? Three-year-olds come into your kitchen holding something that they've just drawn. You have no idea what it is. And they tell you, please put it up in the refrigerator and let's charge the neighbors money when they come to see it, because it looks like Van Gogh. Because, like, you really don't have any idea what it is. But they are so excited that you're excited to put their artwork, because they can't help but make stuff. You're great longing, because this is the first two pages of the Bible. That's who we are. We are also people of great grief, because we get to the third page of the Bible. And grief is a word that I use as a placeholder for all the things that are not just merely unpleasant, but there are things that we have experienced that are unpleasant that we hold in the isolation of our own selves, with nobody else being aware. And so grief can be my sadness, it can be my rage, it can be my shame, it can be my fear. We arrange things, my loss, all these different things. The real question is, when these things happen, when grief comes, even in the face of my longing, and one of the things we know is that grief and trauma has this way of shearing off our longing, so I stop wanting things, so that when Jesus comes along in John chapter 1 and says to John the Baptist's disciples, what do you want? They're like a little flummoxed. right? To answer the question, what do you want, can feel risky. I might not know what it is. Or if I know what it is it the right answer? Am I going to piss God off if I don't tell him exactly what he wants to hear? Kind of like, what is it like growing up in my house? These kinds of things. When we are encountering these things within us, we recognize that glory is about discovering joy in the presence of both longing and grief. Because the reality is that in this world, you will have tribulation. I didn't make up that line. In this world, we will have tribulation. With our longing, there will be grief. But before this, Jesus says this. He says, I said these things to you so that in me, you will have peace. I said these things to you because in me. He doesn't say, I said these things to you so that in these words you will have peace, so that in this philosophy you will have peace, in doing the right thing you will have peace, in me. I want you, just like Peter, I want you to pay attention. You want to pay more attention to me than you're paying attention to your shame. I want you not to ignore or to bury or to minimize or to pretend it doesn't exist, your grief. I want you to bring your grief to me. Bring all of your heavy laden stuff. Bring it to me. And when you and I look at this together, you are going to change and the stuff is going to change. But for most of us, we don't have the kind of experiences with relationships that enable us to be practicing naming our griefs so that we can get back to naming our longings. But what Paul is saying is that something has happened to him, not just on the road to Damascus, but in the connection of the community that he's had. Imagine, if you're Paul, and you had this thing that happens on the road to Damascus, while you're on your way to kill people, and now you can't see, and now you hear and you understand that your guys are going to take you to the people you are going to kill. If you're Paul, I'm thinking like, this is my last day on earth. You're right? Because you think about it. Like, we don't think this. We hear, Ananias, the guy in Damascus who gets the news, hey, the mafia is coming. We're bringing the mafia. They're blind. They don't know where they are anymore. And they're coming to your house. We want you to pray for them. And they're like, the hell I will. Right? This is what Ananias says. But it's Paul. It's Saul who's coming. And God's like, yeah. But can you imagine if you're Saul? Can you imagine what it's like, how frightened he will be? Are you with me? But he gets there, and what does Ananias do? Ananias takes him in, keeps him, feeds him, shelters him, gets him cleaned up, prays for him. This is not just about what happened to Paul on the road. It's what happens in Ananias' kitchen. It's about glory happening to us in the presence of our cloud of witnesses in ways that it can't happen in the privacy of my own mind. Who are the people by whom you are being so deeply known that God's glory that we've talked about, the glory of the only Son of the Father, is something you're experiencing on a regular basis? Not that that experience prevents you from suffering, but such that that experience prepares you for when it shows up. Because it's now, with this front-loaded way of understanding what it means to be a follower of Jesus, these are the living, breathing, embodied, felt sense of assumptions that we're making, that we then come to this. Suffering is a response to our pain over time. You read this in the literature. It's our response to pain over time. If you had a significant pain right now, 10 out of 10, but it only lasted for 30 seconds, the amount of suffering that you would have would be of a certain nature. If that same pain lasted for 30 minutes, it would be different. If you had a paper cut right now that lasted for 30 seconds, that would be minor. If you had a paper cut that lasted for 30 days, now it's starting to make you mad. You with me? So it's not just the kind of injury, and it's not just how long, but it is our experience of pain and our response to pain over time. But three things, at least, ways in which we suffer. Because of things that happen to us, all of us here in this room, we can imagine the things that have happened to us. Things that have happened actively, things that have happened because of neglect. The second thing is we suffer because of things that we do to ourselves. And it would be fair to say that this second category is far greater in its volume and its causality than is the first. Things happen to us when we are children, and then we tell a story about this thing that has happened to us when we're children, as we've headed to adulthood, and we think that the suffering that we have is because of what happened to me when I was 16. When in fact, no small part amount of the suffering that I have experienced has a lot to do with the story that I had told about what happened to me when I was 16. And this is crucially important when we're working with our patients, because sometimes the patient will come in and for the very first time, they're telling you about the sexual abuse that happened to them when they were a teenager. They're now in their 40s, they've told no one, and they want to talk about their suffering. And we think that their suffering is primarily about what happened to them during those 2 years. Neurobiologically, that's not the data. And this is where things get tricky. Because part of what we're going to have to do is to help them pay attention to their role in the storytelling process that has continued to strengthen shame's grip on the story that they tell about themselves. Now, this is not a binary thing. This is not to say, oh, it was either something that happened to them or it's something they do to themselves. This is all running together. And it is not to say that the very first time that we meet a patient, that it's our job to say, oh, I just want to let you know that most of why you're suffering has nothing to do with what happened to you. We're not here to say that. But it is for us as clinicians to be wise to the fact that this is what's actually happening in the room. We live in a world in which it has become fashionable to misappropriate the use of the word safe. I don't feel safe. Okay? Now the word safety has been used by people for a long time in a typical way, but we have now reached a moment culturally where it is being misappropriated. And we all know this, and there are times in which you say, when I say, I don't feel safe, is a way for me to say, I don't really want to do hard things. Okay? Which is one reason why we tell our patients when we begin to train them in this way, we begin to say, I'm going to ask you to refrain from using the words not safe. I want you to stop using them. Because when you say, I'm not safe, I have no idea what you're talking about. I really don't. Because you're telling me what you're not. You're not telling me what you are. When you feel not safe, what you're really probably saying to me is, I feel afraid. I feel worried. I feel a lot of them. I can name these things. And the reason why that is important is because if you tell me that you're afraid, we can do something about that. And in fact, we can give you things to do that will give you agency in changing the degree to which you feel afraid. When you say, I'm not safe, most of the time what we're really saying is, the environment outside my skin is not what I need it to be. Which means for me to feel safe requires the environment to change and for me to do nothing. When I say I feel afraid, I can begin to ask you questions about what do you want to begin to do to strengthen your comfort and confidence being in the room so that you are not afraid. What are we going to do, you and I together, you and the community, what are you going to begin to do to strengthen this? Now, to be clear, this is not to suggest that people, it's only about that, and that people don't live in toxic environments. People do. I have people in their 40s and 50s who have parents who are in their 80s and 90s who still find ways to behave very badly. Very badly. And they continue to do things that hurt the people who are in their 40s and 50s. And those are things that happen to them. This is the first category. They happen to them. And then they say, like, yeah, every time I go over to visit with my mom, I don't feel safe. I want to say, wait, I want you to start to talk about what you do feel so that we can start to talk about what you then want to do or choose not to do with them so that you recognize that you have far more agency than you know. This is why it's really important for us to differentiate in terms of, like, what is it that we are doing that is adding to our suffering? Are you with me? All right. And then the last thing is this. It's a function of growth and resistance to disintegration. You know a teenager's room. Right, a teenager's room, when left to its own accord, will become, a teenager's room. Right? We kind of know this. Right? It's like entropy. It's just like the things are just flying up. Everything's flying off. The wheels are flying off. It requires energy to have a teenager's room be neat and tidy. It requires energy for us to move toward integration. When left alone to ourselves, we will become disintegrated states. That's what we will be. That's what we'll be. And that's what evil is counting on. That's what evil is attempting. Evil is actively trying to move us toward one side or other of the river of integration, either toward chaos or toward rigidity. It is trying to disintegrate us. And resistance to the disintegrative process is going to be painful. The resistance to my addictions is going to be hard to do. Amen? There will be a certain suffering that takes place. Any athlete who's moving to the next level will talk about the amount of suffering that is involved in moving to the next level. There is a certain painful enterprise that goes in. When Jesus says in Matthew chapter 5, at the end of the Beatitudes, blessed are those who are persecuted. Blessed are those who are, like, all kinds of evil is set against you on account of me. As Tozer said, to a world that's running away from reality, those of us who are running toward it will seem like deserters. Are you with me? There is a certain suffering that is going to take place if we are going to choose to be followers of Jesus. Because he is going to ask us to say no to lots of things that I would much rather do that are not good for me to do. I would much rather just lose my temper with my wife. And he's like, no, it's not an option. And so I'm going to have to work at that. And that work is going to be hard. And it's important for us to know this. Like, it's tempting in all these situations, no matter what the category is, it's tempting then for us as part of our suffering to say, yeah, so suffering, yes, I understand it, and I shouldn't complain about my suffering. You ever had that experience? I'm suffering, but I shouldn't complain about it. Because we know that suffering's happening. I shouldn't be able... No. Part of the working through of suffering includes complaint. It includes lament. It includes, this is really not very fun for me. One of the things that is problematic for us is that we tell the story that I don't deserve to talk about my suffering. That's not true. Again, we have an entire Psalter. And you think, like, couldn't the Jews come up with, like, why do you have to have 150 Psalms? Like, couldn't you do it, like, 5? Maybe 10, like, why take up so much papyrus? Right? When you're, like, why do you have to have 150? It's because these are people, and many of these Psalms, like, you've read one, you've read them all. Like, they're just repeated, right? And you think, you know, if you're a guy, like, back in Psalm 37, I already heard this, right? So we're now in 73, and you're repeating it? Like, no. We tell people who come to these confessional communities, because they'll talk about their suffering, and then they'll say, this has been great, thank you very much. And we'll go out of our way to say, look, it's important for you to know, there's going to come a time when you're going to feel this again next week or 6 weeks from now, and you're going to be tempted not to tell us, because that unclean spirit that's going to come into the room is going to say to you, you already said this to them once. Don't trouble them. Where have you heard that before? There was a story that we were talking about earlier today. Jairus comes because his daughter is sick. And he's complaining. And he's asking for the master to come. And on the way, the master gets held up. And after the woman with the bleeding problem is, after that is resolved, while he is still speaking, someone came from Jairus' house to say, don't trouble the master anymore. Your daughter is dead. And it's in that moment that Jesus says, no, 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 no. just believe.
Let's go do this.
It's important for us to communicate to our patients that as long as their grief is in the room, we want to hear it. As long as their suffering is in the room, we want to hear it. Jesus is not overwhelmed about it. Jesus is not worried about it. Jesus is not keeping track of benchmarks of your progress. Jesus wants to know that you're in the game. I want to know that you're in the game as the therapist. Now, it is fair to say that there are, I don't know if some of you, I've had the experience of people who come to therapy, kind of like some people go to AA. Some people think that going to AA is the same thing as being in recovery. If I just go to meetings, right, you're with me. Some people think that coming to therapy is the same thing as doing therapy. Right? Because they come and they see you for an hour, and somehow that hour, once a week, for who knows how long, is going to magically transform their life. Which, in fact, what they're coming to do is the same thing you're coming here to do. They are coming to be inspired in order to go home and do the work. Now, yes, they're doing the work in the office with you, but that's 1 hour a week. And they're going to walk out of your office, and they're going to be confronted by an entire world that is trying to form them in the completely opposite direction. And so there are some who just come to therapy thinking that that's what it is. And they think, well, gosh, like, no, I can think of patients where, you know, where we've come to the point where I said, we've been visiting, we've been meeting for such and such amount of time, and that amount of time, we've asked you to do this and this and this and this, and it seemed like it's been hard for you to do those things. And so I'm going to give you a month. And a month from now, if you come back and you haven't done any of the things, then we'll call it a day. And we'll say, you haven't yet suffered enough to make the changes that you need to make. This is important to know. Human beings, mostly, don't make changes until or unless they've suffered enough. It doesn't mean that until or unless they've suffered. Many people suffer. But they're not yet willing to do the work that is required that their suffering is inviting them to do. People come to see therapists sometimes because they want to come to be not sick. They don't come to be well. The rich young ruler wanted something from Jesus. He hadn't suffered enough. And it wasn't because he just had way too much money. It was because he was so well practiced. He was so well practiced at believing that you have to earn the right to be loved. His money was just a symbol of that. And if I'm practicing that, it's going to be a while for me to suffer enough for me to let Jesus love me. And so we take care of people who come in our door. And you know, you've been trained. You've been trained that when somebody comes into your office, you're going to work with them until, like, they're 85 years old. Even if they're not working to do the work, you're going to stay with them, right? And you're going to find it, and because we're thinking, oh gosh, if they haven't done the work to make the change, certainly there's something about what I'm doing or not doing as a therapist is the reason that we're not making progress here. Right? Perhaps they're just not yet ready to do the work. And perhaps they're going to see you for 6 months and make no changes, and you're going to think, I've been completely unhelpful for this person. And what we, if you were in our practice, we would say, we would want to remind you that those 6 months have been absolutely necessary for whatever change God is going to eventually write in them. That might not happen for another 10 years. But this is why we, even as therapists, need others who can help us discern when is enough enough. When have people gotten to a point where they have not yet been willing to cross the threshold of their suffering enough to make changes? Does that make sense? Okay. All right, I think that we have, we're clear about that. We're going to do this, and we'll come back to this in 15 minutes. We've been at this for 75 minutes. We're just going to turn you loose, go get something to drink, go pee. It doesn't have to be in that order. You can pee first. We'll come back and start at 4 till.